Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Great to be here.
Today we're looking into a really difficult but vital part of history. We're talking about the famines that impacted Kurdish communities across the 19th and 20th centuries.
Yeah, it's a history that, well, as the material you shared really shows, it's often overlooked, isn't it?
It really is.
Yet it involves just immense suffering, immense loss. So our goal here really is to go through these documents, these reports you've provided, and sort of pull out the most significant points.
Right, to help us all understand these crises that have often been, you know, left in the shadows.
Exactly. We'll be looking at Kurdish areas within the Ottoman and Persian empires, historically speaking, and then, of course, the modern states that came later, Turkey, Iran, Iraq, Syria.
And the sources, they give us a pretty close look, don't they, at the causes, the characteristics, and the often devastating consequences.
They do. So maybe let's start back in the 19th century, within the Ottoman Empire specifically. The 1870s, that was a period of really severe famines hitting Anatolia, and that included Kurdish regions.
Yeah, what really struck me in the material was how these weren't just bad luck with the weather. I mean, yes, there were droughts, floods, terrible cold snaps. Mm-hmm. But it was amplified, wasn't it, by the whole economic and political situation globally and inside the empire. One report even mentioned local, imperial, and global man-made reasons.
That's a really critical point from the sources. It frames these not as, you know, simple natural disasters, but as these multi-layered crises.
Multi-layered.
And the scale.
Yeah.
It is just staggering. The 1873-1875 famine alone, the estimates are at least 100,000 deaths.
100,000, just from that one famine. And then, wasn't there another huge one right after the Russo-Ottoman War, 1879-1881?
That's right. Tens of thousands more deaths around Diyarbakir, and at least another 10,000 in eastern Anatolia from that one.
So how is it possible that events on this scale are, as one source put it, almost invisible in European and global famine historiography? Seems hard to believe.
Well, that's a key puzzle the material raises. They get overshadowed by later catastrophic events, for one thing.
Okay.
And there's a pretty strong case to be made looking at the sources about the Ottoman state's condition back then. Remember the sovereign default in 1875?
Oh, right. They basically went bankrupt.
Pretty much. So you have a weakened state, severely limited capacity to organize any kind of relief, especially way out in the peripheral regions like Kurdistan.
And that probably affected record keeping too, I imagine.
Almost certainly. Less capacity for relief often means less documentation, making it harder for later historians to piece together what happened.
So the empire's financial collapse had a direct, brutal impact on people starving far from Istanbul and the social consequences. They sound immediate and just terrible.
Oh, they were. The sources detail some horrific things, especially the impact on children. Accounts of kids eating harmful things just to survive.
Okay.
Being traded for bread, abandoned when families had to flee, or being exploited. It paints such a grim picture, you know, especially when you contrast it with these emerging ideas in the cities about protecting childhood.
That level of desperation.
Yeah.
It must have just torn society apart. The documents mention unrest too, right? Like bread riots.
Yes, bread riots in Diyarbakir in 1880. People directly challenging the authorities. And it's interesting, the sources note that sometimes these riots included both Muslims and non-Muslims.
So shared hardship could sometimes bridge those divides.
It seems it could, at least in certain moments. But the crisis also exposed and, frankly, intensified the underlying tensions, too. It definitely shook the state's legitimacy and its ability to keep order.
Let's focus a bit on that 1879-1881 famine, the one in the eastern provinces Erzurum, Van, Diyarbakir. The sources seem to highlight a really disturbing trend there, the way it sharpened ethno-religious divisions.
Yes, this is where the crisis really hits existing vulnerabilities hard. You had pastoralists, often nomadic or semi-nomadic Kurds, whose livestock, their entire livelihood, died in the severe cold. Okay.
So, starving themselves, they started targeting the grain stores and the remaining livestock of the settled peasants, who were often Armenian Christians in those areas.
So, desperation pitting group against group, fighting over scraps.
Precisely. The sources give specific examples like monastery mills being plundered in Van province around 1880.
Wow.
And reports of oxen, which had actually been given out as aid by the Armenian Charitable Commission in Baskal, being stolen.
So it moves from maybe individual acts of desperation to something more organized or at least targeted.
It seems that way. And the material points to a really significant and worrying shift later in the century, by the late 1880s, 1890s.
What was that?
This kind of raiding, especially livestock theft, seemed to become more organized. Mm. And alarmingly, it starts involving the Hamidi regiments. These were state-sanctioned Kurdish tribal cavalry.
A state-sanctioned?
Yes. And the sources specifically highlight how these regiments began raiding Armenian villages. Okay, that sounds less like desperate people fighting each other and more like the chaos is being used, maybe even directed, by the state along ethnic lines.
That's certainly how the material frames it. It talks about an accelerated violence targeting the very basis of Armenian agrarian life. And it links this directly to the rise of using ethnic and sectarian identities as tools for control and mobilization.
So the argument is, the famine combined with things like the environment, the debt crisis, maybe new weapons, it all gets filtered through these power structures.
Exactly. And imposes hardships unequally, fueling conflict along those pre-existing fault lines. It's a stark reminder of how environmental and economic shocks aren't neutral. They interact with politics and society.
A really powerful and grim example. Okay, let's move into the 20th century. World War I. The sources describe this as just a catastrophe of unprecedented scale across the whole region, right? Ottoman and Persian Kurdistan both hit hard.
Unprecedented is the right word. You have collapsing empires, huge armies marching back and forth, and deliberate state policies all converging to create devastation for civilians.
In Ottoman Kurdistan, the Allied naval blockade alone sounds crippling.
Absolutely. That blockade went on until 1919, after the war technically ended.
Right.
It just choked off vital supplies, leading to widespread starvation.
And meanwhile, the Ottoman state itself, it was basically sacrificing its civilian population for the war effort, wasn't it?
That's what the sources suggest. Ruthless requisitioning of property, animals, farm tools, and crucially food from everyone, including Kurdish communities.
And the economy just collapses.
Completely. The blockade, losing export markets, one source uses the Mount Lebanon silk trade as an example, but the mechanism would be similar for Kurdish areas.
Yeah, makes sense.
Plus remittances drying up, hyperinflation.
Yeah.
It all hit incredibly hard.
And then add refugees fleeing the fighting and huge numbers of men being conscripted, so fewer people left to farm.
It's the perfect storm for famine. Southeastern Anatolia, places like Diyarbakir, were just ravaged by hunger and fighting during the war.
And the material highlights something particularly brutal in the Ottoman lands. Forced displacement. Deportations on a massive scale.
Yes. Starting around 1916, Ottoman authorities forcibly removed an estimated 700,000 Kurds from eastern and southeastern Anatolia, marched them westward.
700,000 people?
Yeah.
Uprooted. What were the conditions like on those marches?
Unspeakably bad. The sources estimate that somewhere between 350,000 and 400,000 of those people died.
Half of them
died.
Yes. During the marches or in the resettlement areas they were dumped in, died from hunger, exposure to the elements, disease.
And this wasn't just, you know, an accidental byproduct of moving people during wartime.
No, the material is quite explicit here. It frames this as a deliberate strategy. It was about clearing Kurds out of strategically important areas.
Okay.
And the displacement itself, the way it was done, was essentially a tool designed to create famine-like conditions designed to cause mass death. It mirrors actions taken against Armenians and Assyrians around the same time.
Weaponized hunger through forced removal. That's a chilling phrase.
It is, and it's a theme that, unfortunately, we see recurring.
Even in the areas that would later become Iraqi Kurdistan, the sources mention villages already devastated by Turkish and Russian armies before the British arrived, leaving people starving, needing aid right after the war.
That's right. And that brings us to Persia, or Iran. The Great Persian Famine of 1917-1919, described as one of the worst calamities imaginable, hitting Kurdish western provinces like Kermanshah and Hamadan really hard.
Even though Persia was officially neutral in the war.
Neutrality offered little protection, it seems. Estimates for the total death toll in Persia are all over the place, from 2 million up to maybe 8 or 10 million. It's hard to be precise.
Wow. Such huge numbers.
But the impact on Kurdish areas was definitely profound. And it wasn't just one thing, it was multi-causal.
So what were the factors driving that famine that the sources lay them out?
Yeah, they do. You had successive droughts, yes, and pest infestations damaging crops. That certainly made things worse.
Okay, so some environmental factors.
But a huge driver, according to the material, was the presence of occupying armies. British, Russian, Ottoman. Even though Persia was neutral, these armies were marching through, fighting each other on Persian soil.
and taking the food.
Exactly. Requisitioning, confiscating food on a massive scale. Kermanshah and Hamadan were right in the thick of it, major battlegrounds and transit routes, so they suffered heavily from this.
So the armies literally ate the food out of people's mouths.
Essentially, yes. And then internal factors just piled on. Widespread hoarding and speculation, landlords, merchants, even reports mentioning officials, maybe even the Shah himself.
Hoarding food during a famine.
It drove prices sky high, made food impossible to get for ordinary people. It fueled a lot of anger and unrest.
So it's the perfect storm again. Environment, military action, internal greed, state weakness.
And transport just collapsed. The war, the armies taking all the pack animals. It became impossible to move food into these regions or even within them. Communities were cut off.
And the Qajar government was too weak to do anything.
Too weak to manage the crisis, too weak to import food effectively. It was just a complete breakdown.
The human stories cited, they're just harrowing. Kermanshah, Hamadan.
They really are looting bakeries in Kermanshah. In Hamadan, reports of people eating grass, dead animals, even... horrifyingly, mentions of cannibalism in some accounts.
Unimaginable.
It speaks to a society pushed utterly beyond the breaking point.
And disease, I assume, followed close behind.
Inevitably. Cholera, typhus, and then the Spanish flu pandemic hit right in the middle of this. It just ripped through these malnourished, weakened, often displaced populations. It added massively to the death toll in Kurdish areas.
The material calls it a human-made famine, doesn't it? Emphasizing the role of the occupiers and the internal actors.
Yes, there's a strong emphasis on culpability. It's also sometimes called holomene, I believe, and it's referred to as a silenced memory.
Silenced? Why silence?
Well, like the Ottoman famines, it's not widely discussed or commemorated, especially internationally. This scale of suffering, perceived as being caused by foreign armies and a corrupt, ineffective domestic elite, it certainly destroyed whatever legitimacy the Qajar dynasty had left.
So it probably laid the groundwork for future upheaval, even if the sources don't draw a direct line to specific Kurdish movements right then.
Absolutely. Widespread devastation like that leaves deep scars and inevitably fuels discontent that shapes what comes next.
Okay, wow. That period, World War I and its immediate aftermath. It's incredibly heavy to process. I think, yeah, maybe we need a quick pause.
I agree. It's a lot to take in. The weight of this history is significant.
Ooh. Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roche Bosch, Hannah.
Welcome, Hannah. Perfect timing.
Oh, that smells wonderful today, Hannah.
Is it good?
Yes. Okay, great. Maybe just a little sugar for me today, please. Thank you so much. It's always such a welcome sight.
Thank you, Hannah. Yes, much appreciated. A moment to breathe is good.
All right. Chai break done. Feeling a bit more fortified. Let's shift gears now. Moving much later in the 20th century to a time where famine conditions weren't just a consequence, but as the sources argue, a deliberately engineered weapon. We're talking about the Anfal campaign.
Yes. Iraqi Kurdistan, 1988, under Saddam Hussein. This was, according to the documentation, a systematic genocidal assault. And the creation of starvation conditions was absolutely integral to the state's aims.
And this connects back to that long-term Arabization policy the sources mentioned.
Directly. The aim, over decades really, was to change the demographics of northern Iraq, especially oil-rich areas like Kirkuk, by forcibly displacing Kurds and settling Arabs, consolidating state control, crushing Kurdish national aspirations. Anfal was the brutal final phase of this, you could say.
And the methods used?
Yeah.
The sources describe them as comprehensive, aimed at destroying the very possibility of Kurdish life in those areas.
Completely. Systematic destruction of villages was key. An estimated 4,500 villages razed. Some sources say up to 90% of all Kurdish villages were wiped off the map.
Wiped off the map. That phrase keeps coming up. The material even quotes internal Iraqi documents using words like villages being burned, destroyed, demolished, purified. Chilling.
It is. And it wasn't just homes. They went after the agricultural infrastructure. Deliberately laid an estimated 15 million landmines.
15 million. Why?
To make it impossible for anyone to return and farm or raise animals. They demolished wells, irrigation systems, even schools and mosques. Anything that supported community life.
So it wasn't just about removing the people, but poisoning the land itself, destroying their connection to it, their ability to live there ever again.
Precisely. And alongside this destruction, there was systematic looting. Iraqi army units and also these pro-government Kurdish militias called Josh stole everything, property, farm equipment, and crucially, livestock, taking away people's means of survival.
It sounds like a strategy to completely dismantle Kurdish rural society.
That seems to be exactly the goal described, and this destruction went hand in hand with mass displacement and internment.
How many people were affected?
The estimates range from 1 to 1.5 million peasants forcibly uprooted from their homes.
1.5 million people. Where did they go? What happened to them?
Many were herded into internment camps. Others were simply trucked to barren deserts in southern Iraq and abandoned.
Abandoned?
Yes. Just left with little or no shelter, food, water, or medical care. Deliberately.
That's inhumane.
And tens of thousands, particularly women, children, the elderly, those not immediately targeted for execution were held for months in horrific detention centers. The sources are clear. They were deliberately denied adequate food, clean water, medical attention in these places.
And the people in these villages, they were already suffering before Anfal even started, weren't they?
Yes, that's an important point in the material. Many of these targeted areas had already endured years of economic blockades by the government, harsh food rationing. They were already weakened.
So Anfal was the final devastating blow, combining ground attacks, deportations, destruction.
Summary executions, bombings, and of course chemical weapons. Halabja is the most infamous example.
Right, Halabja, where 5,000 people were killed almost instantly by gas. That was part of Anfal.
It was part of the broader genocidal campaign in 1988, yes. It spread terror and further weakened the population, contributing to the overall catastrophe.
So the primary targets for execution were men of fighting age?
Generally, yes. Adult and teenage males were separated and executed en masse in many cases, but huge numbers of women, children, and the elderly also died.
But not necessarily from bullets.
Not primarily, no. The sources state very clearly that for these groups in the camps and the displacement sites, death came from, and I'm quoting the sense of the material here, the slower, agonizing effects of starvation, disease, and exposure deliberately inflicted.
Deliberately inflicted. That phrase just hits so hard.
It captures the calculated cruelty, doesn't it?
Yeah.
This was state-sponsored famine, engineered starvation, used as a weapon of genocide.
What are the death toll estimates for Anfal overall?
They vary, as these things often do. But conservative estimates put it at 50,000. More likely, closer to 100,000. Some Kurdish sources go as high as 182,000 killed or disappeared just in 1988.
Just staggering numbers.
Yeah.
And the conditions in those camps.
Squalid, overcrowded, perfect breeding grounds for epidemics. Children were especially vulnerable to diseases brought on by malnutrition. Anfal stands as just this incredibly stark, undeniable example of famine being used as a calculated tool, a core part of a state genocide.
Looking back across all these periods, we've touched on the 19th century Ottoman crises, the devastation around WWI in both empires, and then Anfal's some powerful recurring themes really stand out from the material, don't they? And legacies that continue today.
Absolutely. These famines weren't just isolated bad times. They were deeply complex crises rooted in that mix of environment, economics, and very often politics. And they left lasting scars.
One theme that seems constant is that terrible link between famine and disease.
Yes, the material calls it a symbiotic relationship between famine, disease, and mortality. It's a vicious cycle.
Malnutrition weakens the body, makes people vulnerable to infections.
Right. And then being sick makes it impossible to work, to find food, to care for others who are sick.
We saw examples across the board, didn't we? Cholera in 19th, 20th century Iran.
Typhus during the WWI displacement.
Cholera, typhus, Spanish flu, and the Great Persian Famine.
And deadly epidemics sweeping the Anfal camps because people were deliberately deprived. Hunger, disease, displacement, they feed off each other.
And the human cost isn't just the death toll. It's also about profound demographic shifts, isn't it? And the way it tears at the social fabric.
Definitely. Losing so many people, especially the young and the elderly, changes the whole structure of a population. But beyond numbers, the sources talk about the breakdown of social bonds.
How so?
Families ripped apart, traditional support networks just overwhelmed. Under that kind of extreme pressure, things like neighborly help, charity, they can sadly decline.
And those extreme accounts eating street animals, the reports of cannibalism during the worst of the 1917-1919 famine, they speak to a complete shattering of norms when survival's the only thing left.
They're indicators of absolute desperation. And that idea of silenced memories we talk about, perhaps it's tied to the collective trauma, the difficulty of even speaking about such experiences, especially if the powers that be don't want them remembered.
And finally, The impact on land, on livelihoods, even on tribal structures, that seems like a major legacy, especially from Anfal.
Oh, unquestionably. Anfal led to that mass dispossession from ancestral lands, the settling of Arabs. This created incredibly complex land ownership disputes in northern Iraq that are still being grappled with today.
So Article 140 of the Iraqi Constitution, that's related to this.
Exactly. It's supposed to address these issues, reverse some of the Arabization policies, but it's been fraught with difficulty. The map of who lives where, who owns what, it's still deeply marked by Anfal.
So policies from the 80s are still shaping land rights and conflicts now.
Absolutely. And even going back to the 19th century Ottoman famine, we saw how it shifted resource access, led to pastoralists raiding farmers, and eventually escalated with the Hamidi. That fundamentally changed land use and economic relationships back then, too.
And World War I, how did that impact things like tribal structures?
Well, the devastation put immense pressure on tribal leaders. The sources suggest that needing to rebuild to provide for their people after the war could have both strained their authority, but maybe also reinforced it if they were able to deliver.
Interesting.
And there are hints of broader economic shifts, potentially increasing vulnerability, like maybe a move towards cash crops like opium in Persia. If you rely on selling a crop to buy food, you're vulnerable if markets collapse or prices plummet during a crisis. These changes, especially around land, they continue to shape the socio-political reality.
This has been, well, difficult, but such an important exploration of the history of famines in Kurdistan, drawing on the material you brought to us.
They really emerge as these profound crises, don't they? So much more than just food shortages. Always complex, always involving that interplay of environment, economics, and politics.
And that recurring pattern, the vulnerability, often made worse, tragically, by the deliberate weaponization of hunger. Whether through imperial neglect or outright state genocide like Anfal, it's a deeply disturbing thread.
It really underscores why remembering these events is so critical. Many remain silenced memories, as the sources call them. Acknowledging them is vital, not just for historical accuracy, but to recognize the immense human suffering involved. Whose stories get told and whose get silenced often reflects who holds power.
And the legacy is clearly still with us. Altered demographics, damaged social ties, ongoing land disputes, collective trauma.
All of which leads us to maybe a final thought for you, our listener, to reflect on, based on everything we've discussed from these sources. How does this history, this pattern of acute vulnerability to famine, so often intertwined with conflict and political marginalization, how does it continue to shape the challenges facing Kurdish communities today?
And perhaps just as importantly, what does acknowledging these often forgotten tragedies tell us about the politics of memory itself? And maybe about the profound human cost of statelessness, of lacking that structure meant to protect you. Something to definitely think about.